This week on Triangulation, my old friend Jono Bacon's back. We're going to talk about creating communities. His new book, People Powered, next on Triangulation.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Triangulation, episode 414, recorded Friday, September 13th, 2019. Jono Bacon. Triangulation is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Hiring isn't easy, but there is one place you can go where hiring is simple and smart. That place is ZipRecruiter, where growing businesses connect to qualified candidates. Try it free at ZipRecruiter.com/triangulation. And by Capterra. Find the right tools to make an informed software decision for your business. Visit Capterra's free website at Capterra.com/triangulation.
It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get together with some of the most interesting people in tech and spend an hour talking about, you know, kind of the big ideas in tech. Our guest today is an old friend, a longtime friend of the network, and a former community relations guy at Ubuntu. And at XPRIZE. He's the author of a book we talked to him many years ago about the art of community, building the new age of participation. And he's got the second volume in the community series, People Powered. Jono Bacon is here. Hello, Jono. Great to see you.
Great to see you, Leah. How are you
doing? Long-time co-host on Floss Weekly.
Yeah, I enjoyed that.
Open source advocate. We do miss you.
I miss you. Miss you all, too.
Yeah.
I love your studio.
What have you been doing? You've been
not much.
Promoting this community thing.
A lot of Netflix. A lot of Netflix.
Life is good.
Life is great. Yeah, I mean, it's been busy. I mean, I'm consulting with companies. One of the reasons why I started doing that was because I'd done a lot of work in open source, but I really wanted to kind of jump knee deep into other areas, whether it's consumer products or, you know, financial services or whatever, to really understand this.
All around
the notion of community and collaboration. You know, so some companies who I work with, it's how do we build communities inside of a business? Like I was working with various banks around that. But then how do you get people excited about your developer platform or your game or whatever it might be? And I've learned a lot. It's funny, when I left Canonical in 2015, 14, whenever it was, I honestly thought I had a handle on this stuff. and I've realized there was a lot.
It's complicated.
There's so much to this. And I'm as in love with the notion of it and the concept of it and the art and the science of it as ever.
What's the history of community? It feels like when we talk about community, we're talking about things like Usenet, online communities.
Right.
But it has to predate the internet.
Oh, for sure. I mean, the thing that I've discovered is we're fundamentally social species. And the act of being together and collaborating with each other or having a sense of unity with each other is fundamental to the human condition, right? And the psychology of this, a lot of psychology behind that. We like to do meaningful work. We generate social capital, and that builds our reputations and all these different pieces. This has existed long before the computer was invented. Where it's really exciting for me, and one of the reasons why I wrote this book, is that as you know, technology's evolved and grown and is becoming more and more available around the world as a commodity, more and more people are getting online. And it means that there's a better opportunity than ever to develop communities where it's not constrained to a local area, like would happen hundreds of years ago.
The village.
Yeah, where you can have hundreds or thousands of people around the world all united around your mission.
But that brings troubles, too, because they're not physically next to each other.
And that's where the rubber hits the road and the nuance of how you do it. Like the way in which you get people together in person is very different to the way in which you would do it online, and importantly, how you fuse these two areas together as well. So
I'm sorry, a little hand just
turned
reached,
the fire on.
Just reached over and turned on the fire. Are you cold?
It's kicking off some heat, Leo.
It was a little bit like in the Addams Family when that finger comes out and touches something. Just reached over and touched the switch.
Yes.
So excuse us for being distracted. Have you looked into the early history of community, pre-technology history of community? I wonder, you know, we think of modern communities as fractious and that we talk about the tragedy of the commons.
Right.
Is that historically the same, or were all these early pre-internet communities just jolly old fun?
Well, I think because the older communities were in person, by definition.
You could get punched in the nose if you were really
I mean,
a jerk.
Frankly, there is a level of accountability that's removed from an online setting. Yeah. And that's why designing an online environment is so critical, right? And a good example of this is human beings tend to mimic each other, right? So if you have a terrible leader in your community or in your government or in elsewhere, you will tend to get negative behavior. If you have a really good leader, you'll get positive behavior. So the way in which you wire up your community in terms of the norms and the expectations and rewarding good behavioral outcomes is one piece, but then how do people mimic the leadership that they see there?
That's what leadership means.
Exactly. It's there's so much psychology wrapped up in this, which is one of the reasons why I find it so fascinating.
Yeah.
Is that when you marry together that psychology, the right kind of psychology with the right kind of workflow, you can end up getting this kind of collaboration that can really expand. And importantly for me is it develops a real sense of meaningful engagement, which can build retention for a long time. The first thing I write about in that book is this kid called Abiyomi, who was in the Ubuntu community. I've been in Ubuntu for about 6 months at this point.
Ubuntu is the best known kind of commercial version of Linux.
Right, exactly. And I got an email from him, and he told me that he lived in rural Africa. And he'd spend his week basically doing chores around his village and earn a bit of money. And then he'd walk 2 hours to his local town, where he would buy an hour's worth of internet access. He'd contribute to Ubuntu, and then he'd walk home again.
Oh, my God.
And so to him, he was locally, he was just a kid in a village living with his parents.
And he had a community.
Right.
A real community.
Right, exactly. He had his community in his village that he cared about. And then there was this community online that he cared about. And but when he was in that moment for that hour, he was part of a movement. And this is one of the reasons why you've seen a lot of activists forming, and why we're seeing, you know, companies getting behind this as well, like Salesforce, 1 million+ members. We've seen Kubernetes, 2,000 developers working on that. There's all kinds of examples.
I think people realize that in any enterprise, if you could build a community of customers,
right,
that's hugely powerful. They become your advocates. They become your...
Exactly.
Your best representatives. But we've also seen, and I think, you know, maybe when you and I talked about the art of community, we hadn't yet seen how bad it could get
right
on places like Twitter.
Right.
And I think we, in the early days of online communities, we're all very optimistic about it.
Right.
And maybe...
You see, the thing is, I wouldn't describe Twitter as a community.
Oh, okay.
And the reason why I say that is, to me, a community is a group of people in a shared social context, right? So if you have, for example, you know, the people who are hanging out in your...
Our chat room's a community.
Yeah, exactly. There'll be a lot of the same people will show up here every day or to watch the...
We all get to know one another.
You get to know one another, and there is accountability attached to that reputation.
Yes, that's right.
Now, on Twitter...
There's no accountability.
There is individual accountability for the specific person, but there are no norms necessarily within that group. And that's why you get radically different ways of engaging on there.
So it's really true. I think people try to form communities on Twitter.
Right.
But there's nothing to stop drive-bys.
Right.
And so there's always people driving by and throwing things out the window at your little community. It makes it very hard.
Because there's
no norm.
There's no norm, and there is no accountability or social hit. So, for example, if you join a typical open source community and you participate and you do great work and gradually your reputation will grow because of that, because you've been an active participant in your community. But, you know, it's unlikely when you start building that reputation that you're going to just throw it away by being antisocial.
There's a penalty to be paid.
Right. Exactly.
How interesting. Okay, so I have to stop thinking of social media necessarily as a community.
Right, and this is one of the tricky things. And again, one of the reasons why I wrote People Powered is the word community means a million things to a million people, right?
Yeah.
Like, I break it down into three models. I think of consumers, people who get together because they share a passion, they share an interest.
Apple fans are
Apple
a community.
Fans are a good example. I think the Twit audience would be a good example
Absolutely,
of that.
Yeah.
But really, they're fans, and they enjoy being with each other, and they share that interest, and they discuss it, but they don't necessarily influence the thing that brings them together as much. Like, Star Trek fans don't tend to influence the show,
right?
But they're super passionate about the show.
Right.
The second type, I think of, are champions. So these are the people who get together because of something, but they want to do something to help. They write documentation. They make YouTube videos. They advocate. They run meetups.
That's what happens in an open source community,
right?
Because they need volunteers so badly.
Right.
If you care about open source, you're going to contribute.
You're going to do something in some form, probably.
Yeah.
But then the third type is collaborators, and those are people who get together to work on the same thing. And this is like a typical open source project. It would be people collaborating on the code itself. But that subdivides into two areas, particularly in tech, because in tech you get inner collaborator communities where people work on the same thing, like they're contributing to the shared open source project, or they build something on top. So, for example, they build an Android app, or they build an Apple app, or whatever it might be.
Or a library.
Or, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Now, the way in which you build a community for the outer, people who build on top of something, is very different, because typically those developers, they don't really care as much about being involved in the platform itself. Like, right, most Android app developers, they don't really care so much how Android is put together. They have an opinion,
right,
but they don't feel like they should be involved. But what they do care about is a great developer on-ramp, great documentation, great SDK.
The interface to them.
But the people on the inner side, inside of an open source project, they feel like they're members of the team.
Right.
So if they are treated differently, if they have those people in the company, the stakeholder company, they're treated completely different, and the community members don't get the same level of information, or they don't have the same similar kind of experience, you're going to frustrate a lot of people. So there's huge nuances even just within that model. So
this is really interesting. It's, yeah. And I think after reading your first book, I realized how exciting it would be to build a community, but also it's challenging.
Yeah,
and it takes a lot of work and a deeper kind of almost psychological understanding of what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, it's the psychology is really interesting to me. When I wrote The Art of Community, the first edition of it back 10 years ago now, I think it was, I didn't really know a lot about the psychology, and I was introduced by a good friend of mine in the UK to behavioral economics, which is, you know, the art and science of how people behave.
Right,
and essentially,
it's what Freakonomics is all about.
Right, similar kind of thing. And basically, we all make irrational decisions. So, for example, we know that we shouldn't eat fast food.
Right.
We know we shouldn't drink alcohol.
Right.
We know that we shouldn't do drugs. A lot of people do these things despite knowing them. We know we should save for retirement.
Yeah.
But we do these things.
Yeah.
What's interesting is that the patterns of irrationality are consistent with human beings. So I'll give you an example that maps to communities. There's something called the IKEA effect. So if you went out and bought a table from IKEA and I went out and bought a table and we both built our table, you would think yours is better.
Yeah.
And I would think mine's better.
That's the one I built.
Because we overvalue our own creations.
Yeah.
So these...
There's also some theory that IKEA does this on purpose because our ownership of our table makes us loyal to IKEA,
right,
in some weird way.
Right, exactly.
Even though it's a pain in the ass to build.
It's a nightmare.
In fact, the harder it is to build, the better in some respects, right? You really got an investment
in
your flat pack.
Oh, it's a, yeah, yeah.
I felt like that for me, that was an epiphany when I realized, oh, I don't have to do this anymore. I'm not going to build any more furniture.
I'm not a big fan of manual labor as it is, let alone with bad instructions. So,
But that's a good point, is the thing that you made is always better than the thing that I got.
So there's all these little subtle psychological patterns.
Yeah.
That play a huge role in this. Like, another one is I mentioned earlier on, meaning Dan Ariely, who's one of the most notable authors.
We've had him on the show.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
Predictably irrational. Yeah.
And he talked about the impact of meaning. So that his example in, I think it's Predictably Irrational, was a guy who spent weeks working on a merger and acquisition presentation for his company. Spent was sleeping at the office, all this kind of stuff. And then it was canceled and he was completely dejected. And it was because the work that he was doing wasn't going to have the meaningful impact that he was intending. He'd still done the work, but the fact that it didn't have meaning, it wasn't going to go anywhere.
Yeah.
Was,
meaning is so important.
Was disastrous to
it's
him.
It's not, he got paid.
Right.
It was his job.
He got paid. He enjoyed doing it while he was doing it.
Yeah.
But then it was removed. And so one of the things I talk with clients about is you have to start with, what is the purpose of your community and what is the value you want to build? You got to start there. All of the tactics around social media and content and blogging and events and incentives, all that stuff is really important. But there has to be a genealogy back to why is this important and how we are offering value to our members and how can we enable them to do meaningful work. The communities that succeed the most do that.
Our guest is John O'Bacon. His new book is People Powered. Actually, it's not out yet.
No.
November
the 12th.
The 12th.
And this is a paperback copy that is going out to press, but it's actually going to be hardcover.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's an audible.
So. Oh, great.
Yeah.
We love it when it's audible.
Yeah, it's my own dulcet English baritone.
Oh, you read it?
Yeah.
Fun. How communities can supercharge your business, brand, and teams. It is on Amazon right now, but that's a pre-order.
Yep. And I've actually got a thing, a pre-order package where you're asking people a lot to pre-order, right? I don't pre-order anything.
I do.
You do?
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot. I don't pre-order. Really?
I have a bunch of stuff pre-ordered already.
Well, I'm looking forward to your pre-order, Leah.
I'm going to get your book.
So what I did is I put together a package where if you pre-order the book, here it is, you get a whole bunch of perks. So basically you get access to a knowledge base, early access to the book. I'm providing some like one-on-one consulting sessions with people in sweepstakes. There's like a 6-part video series that's incorporated into that as well.
Oh, so definitely go to jonahbacon.com/peoplepower.
So if you pre-order it, basically you get a whole load of perks. So even if you're on the fence, then I think you'll feel like there's a lot of
value.
You're
so smart. Well, I want to, we're going to take a break. When we come back, I think we should talk about what, the steps to building a community, because I like this idea of you don't start with all the structural stuff.
Yeah.
You start with thinking about what that community's meaning is.
Sounds good.
I like it. We're going to do that in just a second. Our show today brought to you by ZipRecruiter. You know, in a way, you're building a community when you build a business, aren't you? You're building the community of people who work in that business. It's a really important thing. The right people can make that community, can make that business sing. The wrong person, just one, can bring the whole thing to its knees. That's why hiring is the single most important job in any business. And that's why ZipRecruiter is the best way to hire. First of all, let's assume that the perfect person is out there. You've got an opening. The perfect person's there. But how do you get to them? How do you reach them? There's hundreds of job boards all over the country. With ZipRecruiter, you post once. Your submission, your posting goes to 100 plus job boards and Twitter and Facebook everywhere. So you're casting the widest possible net. The chance of you reaching that person is so much higher. But then you might say, "Well, but wait, I don't want a million emails. I don't want all these phone calls." No. That's the beauty of this. It doesn't go into your inbox. It goes into the ZipRecruiter interface, and there's a lot of benefits to that. First of all, they reformat the all the resumes so you can scan through them. You can have screening questions, multiple choice, true, false, even essays that eliminate people who just aren't right for the job. And then, and this is really the secret sauce, ZipRecruiter will actually find the right candidates for you from their vast database of people who are looking for work and invite them to apply. Cafe Altura, as I get an example, COO Dylan Miskovitz needed to hire a director of coffee. I want that job. For his organic coffee company, he was having trouble finding qualified applicants. He switched to ZipRecruiter, and that's when that magic kicked in. The technology identifies people with the right experience, invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. Dylan said he was impressed by how quickly he had great candidates apply. We've had the same experience. In fact, we just hired a production assistant. Same thing. As soon as we put that listing up, within just a few hours, we were getting great candidates. With results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. You've got an important job to do. You should use the tools that help you do your job better. Try ZipRecruiter and make your life easier too, by the way. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/triangulation. ZipRecruiter.com/triangulation. ZipRecruiter is the smartest way to hire. ZipRecruiter.com/triangulation. We thank him so much for supporting the show, making it possible for us to interview great people like John O'Bacon. People Powered is the new book.
Yep.
So right away you said something that made me step back, because I think the first thing people do is they figure out the mechanics of the community. Is it going to be a forum? Is it going to be a chat room? How do people join? What do they get? What kind, you know, and instead you say you should be thinking about the meaning.
I think everything has to, in, not just in communities, but everything in anything we do has to start with what is the reason why you're doing it, and what is the purpose of doing it?
I think you particularly have that point of view because of your work in open source, because people often wonder, why would anybody contribute many, many hours of the day building something you're not going to make any money on?
Right.
But I think when you talk to open source developers, they get real meaning out of it.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it's like a good example would be Twit. You know, I'm sure that when you started out
for fun. I wasn't expecting to ever make a living.
Right. But I imagine a lot of it is, okay, well, why should people watch?
Right.
Like, what kind of guests do we want to have on?
Yeah, yeah.
What kind of topics do we want
to
discuss?
We still have to think about that.
Right. The fact that you can see what your community are talking about while you're recording.
That's a feedback loop.
Right. You know, to me, it's the first step is always, and what I always recommend to companies who I work with is what is the mission of your community, first of all? Like, where do they fit into what you're trying to accomplish?
Right.
Do you want them to provide support? Do you want them to perform advocacy for you? Do you want them to build technology? And then the important thing is define what is the value for the member. One mistake a lot of companies make is they say, well, we want to build a community and do these things, right? These
five this
things.
Is good for us. This is great what for we want to get.
And they end up with the most boring community.
Yeah, why would anybody join that?
Yeah. And so start with what your members want, because if you derive value for your members, you will get associative value for your business.
Give me an example. What would that look like?
So I'll give you an example that I reference in the book, actually, which is a company called Fractal Audio Systems. They're based out in on the East Coast. I'm a big fan of music, right? And I play music
at
the studio at home.
Yeah.
They have a product called an AxeFX. It's basically a guitar processor, right? So it simulates guitar amps. So instead of having tons of big amps that most people can't afford to buy, they're all rendered in software. And what they've done is they built a community where people can show up to their forum. They can ask questions about how to use the AxeFX and how it works. But they also get firmware updates and people share videos. And they've basically designed a place where their community can show, it's a very complicated piece of kit, how to get the most out of it. And the level of passion towards the company and the level of passion towards the product is phenomenal.
But doesn't it start with that? I mean, I don't have any passion towards the buttons I buy to sew on my shirt.
Right.
You're not going to be able to start a button community.
No. I mean, a lot of it depends. That's the other thing is, you never know.
You never know. I shouldn't say that, should
I? Anything's possible. There is going to be someone from a button community that's going to email.
Well, my button community is the best button community.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing as well that I recommend is there's got to be a purpose for your community. There's got to be a reason, something for people to care about. I've worked with a couple of clients in the past where they've reached out, well, in the kind of the pre-signing phase where they've said, we want to build a community around this thing. And I've said, I think you're going to struggle
with
it. This.
Yeah.
Honestly, it doesn't mean you can't have niche communities. There's many, sorry, niche. You say it differently.
Niche.
So it's pronounced.
I always say niche, and then people say, no, it's niche.
All right.
So you can't win.
Well, you know, we invented the language. It's okay.
I want to do a podcast. My next podcast is going to be about small differences, big fights over small differences. Things like niche or niche.
Oh, that's amazing. I could talk for an hour on that.
That's because I realize that people are most opinionated about the stuff that they, that there's no expertise involved in understanding. So jiff or jiff, it doesn't matter. What do you, you know, it's, it doesn't, you don't, there's no right.
Right.
So everybody just can have a strongly held opinion.
Yeah, there's no outcome. Everyone's got a strongly held view. You feel like you want a member of the internet. That's, yeah. That's
so it's pronounced Nice.
Yeah, Nice.
Is it Nice?
There's going to always be that guy. He went to Harvard. He thinks he knows everything. So, there are things that you just, makes no sense to have a community.
Yeah. And I
does it need passionate users?
So I think there's a few things to consider. And imagine this is with a company. I mean, it's different for if you're setting up like a hobbyist community. There's a different set of considerations. But imagine this is a company who wants to build a community around their product. The first thing is there's got to be an audience that cares about your product. There's got to be a group of people who...
People have to really care.
Yeah, there's something...
Somebody has to care.
Something that people are going to actually want to spend time investing in. The second thing is you've got to make sure that you can enable enough control to your community where they can do something, right? So, for example, there are some companies, particularly in heavily kind of locked down businesses, such as, again, like financial services, where they can't take the legal risk to even set up a forum.
Right.
I mean, where each tweet goes through 10 rounds of legal review, it's very difficult to set up a community like that. Those communities tend to happen internal. So you've got to be able to say, we can enable people to come in here and shape a collaborative environment in some way.
Notoriously, companies like Apple in their forums will censor their communities.
Right.
Which I think has a chilling effect a little bit on that community.
I think you should only ever remove or censor... I don't think you should censor content. I think you should remove it.
If it's critical of the company...
Well, my view is this. The time when you remove content or you remove people is when the safety of your members is called into question, such as... Or there is...
And that's imperative because it could really degenerate.
Or there's hateful content.
Yeah, yeah.
The sexism, racism...
But if somebody says, I don't like the Apple Watch because it's not always on...
You should never...
You can't take that out.
No, you can't. Because the thing is that if you do that, it completely undermines the objectivity of the environment that you're building.
Well, and also you want to build a community where people feel like they're participating and
right.
their participation is welcome.
Well, and a key element of this is, you know, kind of going back to the what should you put in place, when you set up that community environment, whether it's some, you know, on a social media network, whether it's in a forum or whatever it might be, the communities that build the most momentum and respect are where they feel, the members feel like they can have a critical conversation with the company and the company will engage, right? This is one of the things I've always tried to do with communities that I've been involved in, is to say to our community, we want your feedback. We're not going to get better
right.
if we only hear the right. chorus of people who love what we do.
Right.
And I mean, there is a difference, of course, between constructive feedback and just complaining. And I would always want to encourage the community to be able to express their feedback, if it's critical, in a constructive way. Not everyone's very good at that, right? And you can't expect that in all scenarios. But if you've got people who are complaining about your product and it's reasonable feedback, engage with them and saying, you know what? Here's the thing. You're right.
Right.
You know what? We can do a better job here. And right. even though if your feedback was inelegantly presented, we've taken this and we're having a conversation about this and we're going to make these adjustments. Outside of communities, that delivers an incredibly meaningful experience yeah. to your customers.
Yeah.
Because a lot of companies will do what they'll do. They'll batten down the hatches and say, well, we're going to ignore that. They're just a bunch of wackos on the internet. And they'll ignore that and they'll think that they have the higher path.
This is exactly why so many companies though don't want to start communities. They don't want to. They do already think it's wackos on
right.
the internet.
and that's one of the reasons why I think the architecture of how you design your community is important, because yeah. you want to basically facilitate the right, first of all, an environment that's going to be safe and productive as you can. And that's why you need good leadership, you need a code of conduct, you need good principles in place. But then the kind of activity that you'll get there is entirely going to be calibrated to the kind of discussion that people see. If you go to a typical community and you see generally good discussion, generally positive discussion, you won't get a lot of instances like that. But you'll go to some communities where the point is trolling.
Yeah.
Places like 4chan,
yeah.
right? The point is trolling. It's right. anonymous trolling. So what do you get? You get a load of anonymous trolling.
Right.
So much of this is when you start your community, in the same way that if I invite a bunch of people over to my house for a party, there's just a social environment that people are going to adapt to in some way. They're going to know that, you know, there's certain things that you don't talk about, there's certain jokes you're not going to make, or it's all dependent on the environment that you're in.
So this is kind of something that comes up in our own community, our chat room. One of the things I've made many mistakes. I've
really?
Made them all with the
I've
chat
made
room.
None.
None, amazing.
Just kidding.
One of the things we ended up doing is saying that the chat room, we provide the server, but it's a community run
right.
enterprise, and they make the rules. The moderators come from the community.
Yeah.
But the challenge, and I don't tell them I don't want to hear critical stuff. That's
right.
I don't say that. But there's a fine line, because it's very easy for a community to tilt into one big mass critique.
Yes.
And then it's hard to be positive.
Right.
So, and I let the moderators do this. I think they do actually a very good job of balancing. They allow a certain amount of critical stuff. But if somebody just comes in there and it's just like very negative.
Mm.
Now, a chat room is a very different, weird community, because it's live. It's in real time.
Right.
So, and nothing lives, it scrolls off.
Right, yeah, there's like a short-term memory piece.
It is a weird kind of community. It's not like a forum or other kind of more traditional communities. But I think over time, it's reached a kind of a nice stasis.
Yeah. Well, and I think an element of this is, and one of the reasons why, the skill here really is sifting the signal from the noise.
Yeah. Right?
So there's always going to be whining and complaining in any community, in any human group. The key thing is, I think, when you have a group of people and they feel like no matter what they talk about, no matter how they express their feedback, it's never listened to. It's never internalized in any shape or form. What will happen is you'll get a sense, it'll turn into just complaining, more and more
right.
complaining. Because they'll be of the view, like, they're not listening to us anyway.
It doesn't matter what I say.
So it becomes a therapy session for the community.
Oh, that's interesting.
But to me, when what happens is let's say it's a company in a community, if the company basically is regularly saying, look, we've received some of this feedback, we think some of this is really legitimate, we're evaluating it, and we've made a series of changes based upon it, and it's not just reactive to that storm that's occurring there at that moment, mm-hmm. but it's proactive in saying we want to have a regular engagement. Like, one of the things I always recommend to clients is when you identify your community members who've kind of earned their way through good work and contribution, don't wait for them to provide feedback to you. Reach out to them.
Yeah.
You know, even if it's once a quarter, just hop on a quick call with them. Regularly survey your community members.
Do you give them a title? Do you honor them or recognize them in some external way?
I think it's good to do that because communities broadly have like three phases when people join. I refer to it as, first of all, you're a casual participant. So you show up occasionally, you know, from time to time. A lot of people in your chat channel will do this. And then you'll have regulars, people who are there a lot, most weeks. And then you'll have a small group who are just super passionate about what your community is doing. And I think it's always good to identify in whatever method of contribution, whether it's people writing code, whether it's people participating in a chat channel or something else, how those groups are broken down. And then as people participate more and more, you want them to have a sense that they have a closer relationship with your overall community leadership.
A reward of some kind.
So I'll give you an example. One client that I used to work with is a security company. And when people had contributed a certain amount to this platform, we'd start reaching out to them and, you know, sending them some swag, inviting them to some events. They got to go to some hackathons. And there was like an upper echelon of this company of like the top 20 security researchers. And we added them to a group called the Most Valuable Hackers. And they, for example, would have an email address set up that would go straight to the executive team. They didn't really use it very often,
wow.
but it was a very clear statement yeah. of we genuinely
right.
care about what you think about what right. we're doing here. And they would be regularly involved in, you know, in discussions with the company. So I think differentiating that is really important. The critical thing is you have to have an environment where everybody has an opportunity to succeed there.
Yeah, obviously you don't want to create a clique.
No.
Or an upper, you know, I mean, this is where in authoritarianism, you give people certain titles.
Right.
Suddenly they misuse them.
Right. Exactly. And well, and the thing is, as well, is this is why I think it's got to be based, earned as best you can based on merit.
Yeah.
But the tricky thing is there was, for example, for a number of years, meritocracy was a term thrown around a lot in open source. You know, the idea that you build your reputation based upon the work that you
doesn't
do.
Doesn't matter if you're a woman, doesn't matter
right.
if you're a person of color,
exactly.
doesn't matter.
Exactly.
A kid.
And that was a great theory, but what we've learned more and more in recent years is the reality that is that it's not actually the reality of that in many ways, because if, for example, you are a woman or a person of color and you join an open source community, you're probably going to have a bit of a different experience to a lot of men. So meritocracy to me is a good North Star. It's like rewarding people based upon good contributions is good, but being aware of the fact that people are going to have very different experiences based upon who they are, where they come from.
Yeah.
Like if you're a white guy in California joining a tech community, you're already going to have a very different experience than if you are, you know, somebody who's based in a different country or comes from a different background or whatever it might be, or a different gender. So I think we need to be mindful of our differences, but design an environment where you can reward people for their for great work. So
you're talking here about gamification as well.
Yeah,
that's a double-edged sword too.
Yeah, it really is.
You can make it really fun. I think that's it's interesting because Instagram is now starting to say, well, we're not going to publish the likes anymore, because Instagram's an example. Is that not a community? If Twitter's not a community, I guess Instagram's not a community.
You see, I think of those. I think social media. I don't tend to think of them as communities per se. I think of them as there is the overall Instagram community, but that's like saying, you know, I mean, yes, that's like saying the American community, right?
Right.
Like there
right.
is a community of all Americans, but
so what defines actually, before I get to the likes thing, because in the gamification, what defines a community?
In
we
my mind,
done that right up front.
Yeah, the way I think of it is, it's a group of people who are in a social grouping of sorts. Now, that might be a family of people, it could be a local book club, or it could be an open source project. It's basically, it's a group of people united by a shared interest or a shared mission. So it's people who are connected in that way. I don't tend to think of, I think platforms like Instagram and Facebook and whatever else, they can be tools within that community. So for example, a lot of communities will have a Facebook page or a Twitter account. But that's a tool within that group is the way I tend to think of it. Yeah. So I don't think of Facebook itself as a community.
No, but
I think
some Facebook groups are absolutely
communities. Facebook is a platform with a load of communities on it, is how I tend to think of it.
Yeah, that makes more sense. Yeah. Gamification can quickly make a community degenerate, though. And I think that's why both Facebook and Instagram are looking at turning off that likes button.
Right.
Because suddenly you're playing the game a little differently.
Yeah, it's tricky as well because gamification is a... again, it's like community is a very broad topic, right? So, for example, we've seen gamification perform really well in some areas. So, for example, video games. People love to collect trophies on PlayStation games.
Yeah.
Peloton have got badges for people who accomplish certain
workouts. It's true. Yeah.
And Fitbit has done a really good job.
Yeah.
So gamification can work in many ways. But it works especially well with a one-to-one relationship between you and the product, right? So when I'm on my Peloton... I feel a great sense of reward by getting those badges because I'm accomplishing them myself.
Right.
The tricky thing is that at some point, most people get bored of collecting badges.
Right.
So the first 10 badges are great and people love that. And then they get sick of it because like, whatever, I just got another badge. And if you give badges for, you know, hey, you showed up today, like it devalues it. The tricky thing is when you use gamification inside of community, inside of social settings, you can run the risk of people being worried of not performing, not contributing to the community in the right way because they just want to get the badge. I experienced this when I was at Canonical. I created a gamification platform called Ubuntu Accomplishments. And the idea was simple. We have a big list of things you can do in the community, like reporting a bug, submitting a pull request, running an event, whatever it might be. And we did everything in this platform called Launchpad. And the idea was you can go and browse these things. You can click on one. It'll tell you how you accomplish it. And then you get the little trophy. And very specifically, this was designed for new skills. So I didn't want to have, you know, 10 bugs submitted. Because otherwise people will submit crappy stuff. And you won't get any good results. It really freaked some members of our community out. Because they were worried, well, you know, we're going to get some really bad contributions because they just want the badge. And I get that. And I get why people will be worried about that. So you've got to be very careful, I think, in communities in how you structure that.
I also, my own experience with that is feel lesser of a member of a community because I don't play the game.
Right.
And I don't have all those badges. And now I'm a lesser member of the community.
Right.
Which is also not what you want, right?
Well, and that was another experiment that we actually did when I was at Canonical where we had this idea. It seemed like a great idea at the time. Where basically we'd have something called the Hall of Fame, which was lists of contributors within certain areas. So, for example, the most active developers, the most active docs writers, the most active translators. And for the people who were on that list, for the top 10, 20 people, they loved it.
Yeah.
It felt great. But for everybody else, they felt completely demotivated. And then the other thing as well is, you know, this is where you've got to be careful. For example, we're seeing this trend towards in open source communities where people are donating money towards developers, right? GitHub launched something, for example, where you can donate to a developer. And one of the concerns I had about their implementation was, you know, you might donate to the developer who implements your feature that you want, for example. But what about the many developers who are just trudging through bug reports and keeping your developer infrastructure up and running and all the like the grunt work of maintaining an open source project? They probably won't get the donation as much.
Right.
So there's all, again, it gets really complicated. There's all of these nuances that are wrapped up in it all.
Yeah. That's like real world tipping. I always feel like the waiter gets the tip, but all the people in the back who are actually working much harder get nothing.
That's the thing with me. Like, what about the people who are bussing the tables?
Yeah.
Like, I get that the chef is paid.
Yeah.
And I get that the owner is running a business, but what about the people who bust the tables? They work their backsides off and they don't get
dishes.
Tipped.
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
There's a lot of work involved.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is a complicated thing, but you can also see the huge benefit of creating a community.
Yeah.
What do you get out of having when it really works, what do you get?
So I think the good news is that more often than not, it works pretty well. You know, we do see examples of toxic environments, but more often than not, the major benefits are that you can build a relationship with your audience, whether it's your customers, your users, that is really genuinely long lasting, right? So you can have people who will join. They're not just customers who use your product. They're people who will have a level of commitment to your company, to your brand, to your product, whatever it might be, for a long period of time. That, to me, is one of the most important elements of this, is that particularly in the business world, it's so competitive that it's only a matter of time before someone comes around with a better product.
Right.
What you really want is you want a relationship. It's not just about the product. But then there's so much practical material communities can generate. They can, like, for example, Salesforce have got 1 million members who provide support to other users, right? So that reduces the burden on their support department. Like I mentioned, Harley Davidson, they've got 700 chapters all over the world where people get together to discuss, you know, bikes and biking culture and whatever else. You've got people who are building technology. I mean, open source is littered with examples of people who collaborate to build technology. So the technology that's developed serves everybody. And a lot of the underlying elements of that that no single company or person wants to invest in is spread across the group of users. Right. Translations is another good example. Like, we had a big chunk of this in Ubuntu. I wrote an app one time and it was translated into 11 languages within 24 hours.
Yeah.
And of course, when people have a good experience with this, we naturally tend to share that and refer that to other people. So, if, you know, I think there are countless examples of where you go to a great restaurant, you use a great product, you have a good experience, and then you'll never guess how great this was. It was fantastic. And then that amplifies what you're doing.
I think a lot of us, though, will look at a community and we go, well, of course Apple has a community. Of course Harley has a community. And say, but I could never do that for my restaurant or my plumbing business.
Right.
Can anybody create a community?
For sure. Yeah, for sure. The key thing, I think, is, and this is one of the reasons why I wanted to write this book, is when I wrote The Art of Community 10 years ago, it presumed you were an open source person, first of all. So it's very, very specific to open source. And it kind of dug in at a relatively deep level right out the gate. With this, the point of people powered is, it first of all walks through, like, why is this interesting? Like, the question you just asked, like, why should people care? And what is the value of doing this? And what are the risks of doing this as well? And then how do I go from, I want to do something, through building out a strategy, breaking it down into the work that you'd need to do, and then integrating it across your company? Because the tricky thing with companies doing this is, like, it's not like just the marketing team can do this. You need your infrastructure team to spin up your services. You need your product team to be involved. You need your engineers to be involved. There's a way in which you bake this into a company because it's cross-functional. And a lot of companies that fail at this, what they do is they hire a community manager. They say, here, come in here, build our community.
Yeah.
Off you go.
Do it. Yeah.
And they do a ton of blogging and social media and other stuff that community managers tend to do. And it's good work. But what it doesn't do is it doesn't meet the needs of the reason why the company wanted to do it in the first place.
Right.
So you've got to be able to socialize this across all these different departments. And that's a big chunk of this as well. So I think anybody can, I think there's a lot of opportunity, not anybody can do it, but there's a lot of opportunity available for people to do it if you kind of walk through the right kind of approach.
All right, so, I want to talk about what technologies are available to do this in just a second.
Sure.
John O'Bacon is our guest. He's the king of communities. His first book, 10 years ago, you were on Triangulation. Episode 212 was all about the art of community, building the new age of participation. That's still in print.
It is.
And now there's People Powered, which is a little bit more of a blueprint.
Right.
And the pre-order package is available at John O'Bacon, JONOBACON.com/People Powered.
That's right.
And it sounds like you really want to get the pre-order package.
I'd love it.
A lot of stuff in there.
Yeah. You can all be my friends.
In a way, you're building community that right there.
Right.
Is that, oh, he's practicing what he preaches.
Well, hopefully.
Our show today brought to you by Capterra. If you have a business, we are always talking about technology here. That's what we do. That's our love. And I know there's so many people in business who have technologies they use that they're tied to, they can't live without, but that are from the previous century. They were built on Windows XP and IE8. You have to continue to use them even though they're wonky, they're break, they're buggy, because that's it. That's how you run your business. I want to tell you, there's great modern software for every area of business, and the best place to find it is a site called Capterra. It makes it very easy to find the right software for your business. The big stuff like Salesforce, CRM, project management, e-commerce software, but even like direct line of business software for real estate companies or yoga studios. It's all in there. Hundreds of categories, thousands of programs. Pick the category. Carson always likes to spin the magic wheel and come up with a category and find some software. Public relations software. There you go. I bet you there's a lot of programs. Yeah, 58 programs on Capterra that are public relations software. But let's narrow it down. There are a lot of different criteria, and they're all tailored to that category. So do you want to be able to do email? Do you want to do press monitoring? Do you want to have 100 seats? Do you want it to run on your premises? Or do you want it to run it in the cloud, et cetera, et cetera? Narrow it down. Create a comparison chart side by side for up to four of them. But that's when the magic begins, because once you've kind of narrowed it down and seen all the features of all the programs you seem most useful to you, then you start reading the reviews. Capterra has more than 1 million real reviews from real users. Every day, 1,000 new reviews is kind of a miraculous thing. It makes finding the right software for your business a breeze at Capterra, Capterra.com/triangulation. They work really hard to make those reviews of actual users. They're verified. So you can see what other people who are in your business using that software, what their experience is. This is incredibly valuable. This is a service you would gladly pay money for. But get ready. It's absolutely free. There is no charge. It's not freemium. It's not they're going to charge you later. It's free. No wonder millions of people use Capterra every month. And that's, I think, one of the reasons there is 1,000 new reviews every day, because Capterra users love it and they want to support it. They've got a community. It's an amazing thing. Capterra.com/triangulation. You could try it for free right now. Find the tools you need to make an informed decision for your business. And you know what? Pay it forward. Leave a review. Be a part of the Capterra community. From accounting to zookeeping, Capterra is software selection simplified. And it's free for you right now at capterra.com/triangulation. Thank you, Capterra, for supporting the show. We really appreciate it. And thank you for supporting the show by visiting capterra.com/triangulation. Yeah, podcasting is very much a community-driven thing.
Yeah.
And as it becomes more competitive and there's more new podcasts and all of that, the thing that keeps us alive over 15 years is the fact that there's this community of listeners.
Exactly. Yeah.
They all seem to know each other.
Right.
And that's kind of what you want.
Right.
Now, we use a chat room, but I've tried all sorts of things. I tried Identica back, it's now StatusNet.
Right.
To make our own Twitter. We've tried forums. What technologies should people be looking at to create a good community?
I think a lot of it depends kind of where your audience are and what they do. So, for example, I've worked with some companies where they live in LinkedIn, for example, and we've built a community inside of LinkedIn.
You can have a community in LinkedIn.
Yeah, like a LinkedIn group, for example.
And that actually makes a lot of sense.
Which makes sense, because if that's where they live.
Well, the other reason it makes sense is because everybody on LinkedIn is verified. There are no phony people.
Right, hopefully.
Yeah, well, maybe there are, but really, that's the nice thing.
Exactly.
There's fewer drive-bys.
But for example, then you look at, an open source community, and people tend to use GitHub
handles
or GitLab or, they'll use open tools. And so I think a lot of it depends on, I tend to look at it, okay, where are your audience? What do you want your audience to do? And what are the most effective tools for that audience?
You got to go to where they are, in other words. You can't say, okay, guys, come here, follow me over to the watering hole.
And you can, but it's much harder work. And also, different audiences have a different relationship with the tools. So, for example, I was having a conversation with a client on the way over here today, where we're building with them two communities for their company. One is going to be around decision makers, so the people who buy their products, and then the engineers who implement that in their companies, right? Now, the decision makers are just not going to go to a forum. They're not going to do it,
right?
I guarantee you.
Too much work,
too much time. They're primarily going to engage with your community there through email.
So an email community is a community.
Yeah. Because a lot of it is how do you engage with those people? Like, with that community, for example, how do you invite them to events?
Right.
How do you engage with them in calls or webinars? How do you disseminate information to them?
Is a marketing newsletter, is that an appropriate?
I mean, I think that that can be a tool that's part of it,
yeah.
Right? So if to me, that's not a community in itself where just
it's a one-way street.
Yeah, it's a one-way street. It's a broadcast mechanism.
Right.
So, but for example, with engineers who are looking to implement, they are much more likely to be interested in getting into a Slack channel or getting onto a forum or something along those lines.
Yeah.
The key thing is, one big question I have a lot of people ask me when I'm working with them is, should we use Slack and or real-time channels such as you've got? Like, this is IRC, right?
This is IRC, which is as old. But this community
but it works,
is literally 34 years old.
Right. Oh, well, and it makes sense in the context of what you're doing because people are tuning in to watch the stream. So a real-time channel makes a lot of sense for people to have conversations while they're watching the stream.
Yeah.
Now, the thing...
It's one of the reasons we do a live stream.
Right.
Because most people listen to podcasts after the fact.
Exactly.
So there's no community. It's, you know, you're listening to something that was recorded earlier.
Right.
But if we do it live, then we have at least a venue where some of the audience members, the most devoted ones...
Can tune in and they can chat
can
with
interact
each other.
And can actually... I mean, I watch the chat all day long.
Yeah.
I wouldn't even know how to do a show in the without the chat.
Right. Yeah.
It's like there's nobody there.
Yeah. Exactly.
So that is a real value to those people. The problem is it's a very small number. Of people.
It's a small number. Yeah. Exactly. The way I tend to think of it is a big chunk of how you bring your community together is around some kind of platform, right? And there's basically two types of communication out there. One is structured communication, and one is unstructured. So structured is, you know, people who communicate with each other through for a specific outcome, such as a bug report or a question in Stack Overflow, something along those lines. Unstructured is where people get together to chat more generally. A good example of that would be your IRC channel, or it could be a forum. Now,
or live events, meetups.
Or a live event.
Conferences. Look what Salesforce does with Dreamforce.
With Dreamforce is a good example. Now, with unstructured communication, you can divide that online into two other areas, which is short-term memory and long-term memory. So IRC, for example,
this is very short term,
right?
Very, very short term.
Exactly. Like if you ever try to look for something in the past on Slack or IRC, you're gonna fail.
Yeah.
You're never gonna find it. It's impossible.
Yeah.
Whereas forums such as Discourse, it's much easier to find those because they're broken down in topics. The information is organized in a more structured way, and then you get the benefit of search engine optimization. So most community members, what they tend to do is they'll type into Google something, like they've got a question about your product or something. They'll come to your forum. So they'll come in through Google or DuckDuckGo or whatever. They'll find it and they'll window shop and they'll look at what's going on. And then if they're interested and have a reason to ask a question or to contribute in some way, then they'll sign up. And that's one of the reasons why I recommend to a lot of people use something such as Discourse, because you can optimize bringing people in because they can find you through a search engine or a link on social media, and then they can window browse and they can go and look at all this other content previously. You can't do that with Slack and IRC very well.
No.
People do post IRC logs online, but very rarely do people tend to go through those. So I tend to recommend IRC and Slack for either real-time purposes, such as
broadcast
now,
yeah,
or it's great instant messaging. If you've got a quick question you want to ask someone, if you want to if you want to run like a community meeting, it's great for that. But don't use it as your primary.
So I noticed a lot of support forums, they're active, but you don't get to know somebody so much.
Right.
So I will go in when I have a support issue, I'll get the answer.
Right.
Maybe I'll notice who gave me the answer, but most likely not. I don't establish a relationship in there.
And that's the tricky thing with these different types of communication is in structured communication like a bug report or a Q&A discussion in Stack Overflow.
Yeah.
You never ever see, hey, how was your weekend?
Yeah.
It's you never
not
see
a social
that.
Event.
You see that very rarely in platforms such as forums, but you see that a lot in IRC and Slack.
Yeah. These live things are totally social.
Right.
It's like a cocktail party.
Right. So these are, I find that chat channels are a great way for like casual conversation where it's less critical around an outcome. Because one of the challenges, particularly for a global community, is, I mean, again, right now, you've got people logged into your IRC channel, but the reason why they're here at this moment in time is because they're watching the show.
Right.
But if you, for example, have a global audience and it's less focused on a broadcast, it's more difficult because, you know, if you're in India, and you start work and you're kind of going through the channel, you're going to see a very different set of people than if you're in California because of the time zone.
Right.
So it's a blend of all of these different things.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
So Discourse, which is open source.
Yep.
It's basically forum software, right?
It is. It's modern forum software.
We have a Discourse?
I would recommend you have a Discourse.
All right.
Because what I would recommend is if I was suggesting how you would structure your community, I would say have your IRC channel for your live shows.
Yeah.
But then you've got thousands of people out there who listen to the podcast.
Who
are never going to come into the IRC channel, but they can go somewhere. And I would recommend whenever you post a show, there's a post that goes into Discourse. You'd break it down by the show type. And then imagine like I watch a show and I want to go and ask questions or have a conversation about the show or even invite the guest who was on the show to go and answer some questions there. There's all kinds of opportunities because then you're segmenting your audience into real time and then into.
So what I find we do is there's a gap between what we're doing in IRC, which I feel very good about and has been very successful over the years. And you know, because when you've done Floss Weekly, you've seen the IRC and you could see how engaged they are. And then we also, and it's broadcast, we do tweets and Facebook and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And that just feels like shouting into the wind. It doesn't feel like it's building a community of any kind. And I guess the hope is, well, if you care enough, you'll follow us on Twitter, and that way you'll see something. So really something that's kind of in between shouting in the wind and this cocktail party, something that has some permanence.
Exactly. So the way I would look at it is your IRC is for people who are watching, and that's great. Social media is great for amplifying content. Right, so when you put your shows out there, they go out on social media. But then what happens is the middle ground of this is going to be something like Discourse.
Right.
Where
you hope that people will retweet you and reshare it. And the problem with audio podcasts is it's different with the text. You can copy and paste it in.
Right. And the thing is, as well, is unless you've got a transcript of that show.
Right.
It's the impossible. SEO is terrible because it's the metadata
you can't
around
find
the show.
Anything. Yeah.
So therefore, people being able to. Let's say you have an interview. Let's say you do an interview with somebody, right? And then someone's searching for that person on Google. And then they find a discussion about a show that you've done because the SEO and Discourse is really good. It brings them in there. And then they see at the top is the show that's embedded.
Okay. So, the only reason, and we've had forums in the past, they're a lot of work.
They are.
You have to hire people. You have to get volunteers. Because if they're not constantly moderated, they can really turn into a cesspool.
Well, and one of the reasons why I like Discourse, and I promise you I'm not on commission, it's just a tool
I'm looking at it right now.
A tool that I'm a big fan of is, so forums, to be honest with you, have been awful for years.
Yes.
And Jeff Atwood and Sam Saffron, who co-founded Discourse, they designed it in a way to basically fix a lot of those issues.
I've used every bit of forum, PHP's Bulletin, used Vanilla, I've used every form that's out there. And it's always degraded, and we've just had to turn it off. Basically.
Right. And one of the things that I like about Discourse is as people participate more, they go up in something what are called trust levels. Right. So you start out,
I like that,
and it's
idea.
Like someone knocking on your door. You don't know who it is. But then as they contribute more and more, they go up these trust levels so you can identify who are the most active members of your community, which is almost impossible to do with IRC and Slack. But then what happens is as they go up these levels, moderation capabilities open up. So, for example, when
that's nice. If you can get a community to participate,
so then what
in
happens is your community members start moderating.
Yeah, that's what you really
want.
And
it starts out little things like being able to review flags.
Right.
Then it can go to recategorizing discussions or whatever else. So,
I'm going to have to take a look at this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They do a great, and it's completely open source. It's a great platform.
Since I've talked to you 10 years ago, I've always known the community is, if you can build a community around your business.
Yeah.
There is nothing better. It's better than advertising.
Right.
It's better than anything.
Yeah. It's a legion of people of productive fans.
Yeah.
Who can do
it. Let's say you're a restaurant. How would you do it if you're a restaurant?
So if I was looking, so restaurants are, let's assume it's just one restaurant. It's not like a chain.
Yeah. Could it have a community?
Oh, I think so.
Yeah.
The way I would think about this would be, first of all, your local area is your community, right?
Right.
So the one thing I'd want to do, first of all, is to give people a reason to come in that is beyond just coming in for dinner. So I'd want to, first of all, have like live music, maybe poetry, whatever else it
might
be.
Make it a scene.
And then I would also organize mixers or networking sessions right? So I'd work with the local chamber of commerce. I'd talk to local groups, meetup groups, whatever, and say, you know what? We will give you a discount on the food and or drinks or whatever else, or in slow evenings. Like, most restaurants are not particularly busy Monday to Thursday or Monday to Wednesday. I would say bring people in.
Yeah.
The other thing I would probably I'd probably focus a little bit less on the online side of things. I'd encourage people and I'd incentivize people to write good Yelp reviews.
Yeah.
Because that's where people are going to find your restaurant.
That's right.
They're not going to go to a forum for your restaurant.
No, that's right.
So I would.
So again, you have to think about where people are going to. What's the natural flow instead of trying to force it?
Yeah, and I would also want to build a relationship between the chef. And
that's the hard part.
And the people who are there.
That's why some chefs are celebrity chefs.
Right.
And some chefs are not.
Are not celebrity chefs.
They don't want to talk to the customers.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, this is really great stuff.
Yeah.
The book is People Powered. It is not out until November. So yep. We're a little early with Jono. But Jono Bacon, nobody is better at this than Jono Bacon. And you can get the pre-order package now. Honestly, it's made me think, what can we do? And we have a very active, great community, but I still want to think, what can we do to do better?
Well, and the thing is, as well, is you're going to have a ton of people, I'm sure, that your team can name by name.
Oh, yeah.
Who you just have been around for a while.
Yeah.
And they would be your early adopter moderators.
All right, what do you say? Scooter X, Loquacious. What do you say? Beatmaster, Reverb Mike. What do you say? We're going to set up a forum. Okay. People Powered. Go to Jono Bacon, JonoBacon.com/PeoplePowered if you want to get the pre-release, the pre-order package. It will be on Audible in a couple of months. It will be out in bookstores in a couple of months.
Yep.
And I think this is really great. It's inspiring and a great idea. A great idea.
Awesome.
Yeah. It's really nice to see you again.
It's always great to see you, Leo.
You've got to come back more often.
I know.
How's the music going?
The music, it's been... When my son, who's going to be 7 in November, was born, I wrapped it up a little bit because I was playing loads of gigs. Yeah. And my last show actually was on board the USS Hornet and a festival called Slaughter by the Water. Yeah.
I'm surprised the Navy went for that.
Yeah, we opened up for Exodus. And
nice.
Yeah. So
wow.
I've been really kind of jonesing to get back into
have fun.
Music. Yeah. So I've have written fun. Some music. I just want to get, I'm going to put together a band.
Nice.
So.
Nice. Yeah. I'm sure we'll find out more at JonoBacon.com.
That's where all the action happens.
Or SlaughterByTheWater.com. No, there is no website like that.
Right. Or I hope not.
Maybe there is.
Maybe there is.
Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, Jono. Thank you.
Again, People Powered is the book. Peter Diamandis is the forward. That's pretty heavy-duty stuff.
He's a good guy.
Nice.
And yeah. Have you had him on?
No. Have we had him on?
Yes, we have.
Never mind.
Not for a long time, but we had him on.
It's been a while. I do remember talking to him.
He talked about his book Titan, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, he's a fascinating...
And look at the people who are praising People Powered, including Ali Velshi of MSNBC, Kevin Scott from Microsoft.
Yep.
You've got some big, big names in here.
Yeah.
Jamie Hyneman from Mythbusters. Got some important friends. Thank you, Jono. It's really great to
have you. Good to see you.
We do Triangulation usually every Friday around 11:30 Pacific. Do we do it with the other hosts at the same time, or is it just for me that you do?
No, we do it every, it's same,
every Friday.
Same bat time, same bat channel.
11:30 a.m. Pacific, 2:30 p.m. Eastern time, 17:30 UTC. And if you want to be in the chat room at irc.twit.tv, you can watch or listen to our live stream at twit.tv/live. And that way it's this live interactive experience. But I know most of you have lives and you can't be here on a Friday afternoon. So we make on-demand versions of everything we do available at our website. In this case, twit.tv/TRI. Or you see those buttons on the webpage, you can subscribe. Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Spotify, Stitcher, Slacker, YouTube too. Do subscribe. That way you'll know when the next Triangulation is on. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time on Triangulation. Bye-bye.